Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. In early November, the United Nations Population Fund, the Agency for Sexual and Reproductive Health, warned that only 2 out of 20 health service points and the remaining hospitals are still functioning as they struggle to operate without supplies, fuel, food, or water in North Gaza. This means that out of the estimated 14,000 pregnant and breastfeeding women in North Gaza, if they are able to survive the daily massacres and airstrikes carried out by the Israeli military, their access to maternal and neonatal health care is restricted, to say the least. Across the entire Gaza Strip, the UN agency estimates that there are more than 15,000 pregnant women on the verge of catastrophic levels of hunger. And complicated and high-risk pregnancies linked with negative outcomes have increased, the agency says, while access to safe childbirth services has dramatically decreased, especially in the north. Transportation challenges and a shortage of medical personnel have compounded the crisis. The UN's partners have reported that there has been a rise in premature births and maternal deaths, and many women are forced to give birth without access to medical support. Basic hygiene, medications, and safe birthing supplies have been denied entry by the Israeli army, with thousands of supply kits stockpiled in warehouses in Egypt and Jordan for months, the UN says. Meanwhile, the Lancet Medical Journal published an alarming commentary on the collapse of the healthcare sector, primarily focusing on labor, delivery, and postpartum care in Gaza. The paper says, quote, "The near total collapse of the healthcare infrastructure, coupled with the lack of access to essential medical services, has resulted in a tragic surge in preventable maternal and neonatal deaths. People are being left to navigate an impossible situation. The once celebratory event of childbirth has now become a matter of survival. Prenatal care is virtually non-existent in Gaza. The rise in premature labor is staggering, often triggered by the chronic stress of displacement, malnutrition, and the trauma of witnessing airstrikes. As hospitals struggle to keep up with mass casualties, maternity wards are becoming non-functional. In some cases, women have had to deliver babies outside in unsanitary conditions without the assistance of midwives or doctors." Joining us to talk about prenatal and postnatal health in Gaza and how women are giving birth during a genocide is Heba Al-Nashef. Heba is a midwife and clinician and worked for 6 weeks at Al-Awda Hospital in Nuseirat in Gaza earlier this year. Heba, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this very critical and largely ignored issue about women and families in Gaza.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful to be here.
Well, let's talk about who you are and what you do. First, tell us a bit about yourself, your field of work, and what led you to join a medical mission to Gaza earlier this year as a midwife.
Thank you. So I am a midwife. I trained back in 2008. I graduated and had my bachelor in midwifery, and then I got my master's in midwifery as well. And I've been working in Canada for over 12 years as a registered midwife. I've always had a dream to actually go on a humanitarian mission to serve women and their families in conflict and war zones. I had prioritized being a midwife in Canada first and getting all the credentials and the training to be able to serve in, low resource setting as well. My training originally was in Jordan, and I trained in low resource setting, so I have some experience and have witnessed some really what less than ideal, let's say, birthing conditions and prenatal and postpartum care. So I do speak Arabic. I grew up, as I said, in also in Jordan. And one of the things that drew me into midwifery is the ability to empower women and folks to make decisions about their prenatal care and subsequently to see the transformation that the women go through birth, like during birth and giving birth to their baby, seeing them for the first time and hold them, cuddle them, having that first skin to skin contact, and how powerful this experience and how impactful a woman usually remembers for the rest of her life, how her birth went. And, you know, who held her hand and said, looked in her eyes and said, you know, you got this, you can do it. And regardless to the outcome, whether it's a vaginal birth or like assisted delivery, like forceps, vacuum, or even a C-section, it is important for women and folks to feel safe and to have support and to have the kindness and the gentleness of providers that understand informed choice and the people's autonomy and the importance of their experience, and have, being surrounded by loved ones. So partner, member of the family, their doula, and also transitioning into early parenthood by supporting their choices in feeding their baby, caring for the baby, and just early parenthood overall. And this is very important to shed light on, as women in Gaza, from what I witnessed, they were deprived of a lot of these experiences, and the birth experience was reduced into push your baby out, you know, quickly wrap up the baby, and then, you know, leave the ward, stay there for a couple hours, making sure that everything is fine, and then go to their tent, discharge them from the hospital. If it was a C-section, they could stay for 24 hours. And then, especially for as a first-time mother, going back to your tent or the school that you've been displaced in horrific hygienic, like really unhygienic conditions, and having to care for a wound and for a baby, and maybe the milk is not enough, maybe don't have access to formula, and then having to deal with the consequences of that for their newborns. So it's just atrocious and horrendous beyond anything you could imagine. And so having to reconcile between the world where I am in Canada, we're privileged, we have the resources, we really tailor to the person's experience of giving birth, providing safe and adequate prenatal care for us to see better outcomes, and to not see that many disparities among people. Like, you know, as human beings, you have the right to access to healthcare and to have a safe delivery, and ideally to have a live baby to go home with. And right, then knowing how to feed this baby, how to have all the support systems that you need. So, because this is bigger than just having a baby, it's like future generations rely on this. This is how you form a society. So we have definitely a responsibility to provide these essential aspects of care to women and their babies and their families. This is not light, like a light, just, you know, this is reproductive health, you know, it's a debatable topic, and it's causing polarization. This is really important to shed a light on. I know sometimes it's not as exciting as talking about trauma and mass casualties and, you know, all the things we've seen so far.
But it's, I mean, this is an aspect of the genocides that that people don't really think about.
No,
that as you said, it's these disruptions, these ruptures, these traumas at every stage of pregnancy and birth and postnatal care, and you know, and being able to provide for your children and your families, and how the genocide at every single stage is you know, making you know, making all of those things into catastrophes. So you were in Gaza as a midwife. Can you talk about what it was like in the you know, the first few days of working at Al Awda Hospital in Nusayrat, what you saw, what your training as a midwife in Canada, you know, how your training, what you were able to do and what you were not able to do in Gaza under these conditions.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience to say the least. So here I am after waiting for more than, I think, about a month to enter Gaza. There was a lot of obstacles. And unfortunately, I had been planned to go into Gaza on May 13th just to enter through Rafah. And then on the 6th of May, we heard the news that Rafah was invaded and we can no longer go into Gaza. And having to wait for weeks on end, having had taken a specific time out of work here in Canada to be able to be on a humanitarian mission for a couple weeks, these plans all went out the window, basically. And then we had to go through the coalition of the Israelis, basically, the organization that is gonna determine who gets in, who gets out. So we can get to that later. But finally, after all that trouble, here I am in Gaza. Finally, I'm able to actually go to the hospital. So I arrived to Gaza on the 6th of June. Then I was we organized with also again like with the Israeli, the IDF or IOF, Israeli occupation forces, that we will be going to Al Awda, Nusayrat, because there is Awda in north of Gaza. That hospital, I was never able, like I wasn't able to go there. So we were in Nusayrat. So we had coordinated and had the green light, me and my logistics team, to go to Al Awda. So we arrived at Al Awda and we were supposed to have an orientation. And as we were having an orientation, the buildings start shaking. And we were like, what is going on? And there was a whole fire belt that was just going off. And people were screaming, the women who had just been delivered, it's like there were children. It was a horrifying scene. We didn't know what's happening, right? In the moment, you're like, what is going on? You can just hear bombs going off around the hospital, and you wonder, is that it? Like am I actually going to be able to do work here? I don't know. So later on, we knew that there was the IDF or IOF was had planned a raid to rescue 4 hostages, and at the time what was happening. And that was my first day at Al Awda Hospital. Like I was doing literally orientation. I cannot emphasize that. So we were joking about this is our welcome, basically. And it's like, well, welcome to Gaza. Here we go. Welcome to healthcare, where you're just providing basic human rights, and then you get to experience this. And I understand, like, some people say, you know, you're going to a war zone, what do you expect? It's just like, why does it have to be around the hospital? Like, that's what it is. And, you know, there's a lot of questions that would be raised to why the hostages were near a hospital, etc. But the idea is still people, like there were so many people in that hospital were so worried about their relatives, other healthcare providers that might be targeted in that bomb. And it was not just extracting the hostages, they were actually demolishing a whole building, like the whole building. After the fact, when I went and saw where it was destroyed, like it was literally leveled. And this is a very busy area, mind you. Imagine you're like, you have a hospital in downtown, I don't know, New York or Chicago. Like it's heavily populated. So it was a normal day. People were like shopping around. Imagine all of the people just walking around. And then this raid had started. So after 2 hours of just sitting there and waiting for the raid to be over and for the bombing to stop, then We heard through the news like more than 500 people were injured, 275 Palestinians were martyred, and that's all at the expense of extracting four hostages. And I that you know and you're like, okay. So I went to the labor and delivery unit after this was over, because I was on the third floor or I think I was on the fourth floor with the surgical floor because I was just finishing up the orientation. So I went to kind of help, and I've introduced myself to the midwives on the ward, and we were just sitting in the labor and delivery room. And then there's this woman who came in. She was crying in horror. It was her, I believe, like her sixth baby. And I was like, it just doesn't sound like someone just in labor crying from the in labor. It seems like more horrific. And it turns out that she had witnessed her husband and five children being murdered in front of her during the raid. And here she goes into labor. She's term. She goes into labor and having to welcome this child and give birth while experiencing that trauma and that the pain of loss. So having to deal with all of these emotions that none of the people in the West can even comprehend. So I was sitting there looking and I'm like trying to make sense of this. How do you make sense of this atrocity? And here we are. So she came in, she was about 7 to 8 centimeters, so very close to have a baby. And this is her sixth, so things are going to happen very fast. And we had to sedate her after she gave birth, because luckily we had some medication. And there's like this very a small supply of medications that we have access to in very desperate circumstances. And, you know, I don't know if people are familiar with the mindset of scarcity, but basically you're just not using the medication you have until it's just like the last resource. That's it. And that's last resort. So she needed that. So we gave her some methadone basically to help her cope. And that's it. Like, had a baby, was given that, and she calmed down, obviously. And and then you move on to the next. And the people, like the healthcare workers there, the midwives, the doctors, they're like, yeah, this is not the first. This is what we've been seeing. And at the time, it has been quite a bit. Like, it's been more like it was 9 months of an ongoing genocide. So people had witnessed, like the healthcare workers have witnessed, like some serious atrocities. Like, it's not like one mass casualty or two. We're like just daily. And they've also experienced loss of their own families. So having to imagine also as a healthcare worker that's coming into the workplace trying to provide healthcare when yourself has been like subjected to so much trauma and you're still having to show up and to provide care. And to kind of like, you know, it's like this whole idea of like, you know, I need to have my cup filled in order for me to be kind as a provider and to show up as the best self. So you can't even have that expectation, because people are just so tired, exhausted, whether patients, companions, or healthcare workers. So that was my first shift and my first day at the hospital. And looking during the orientation as well, before the raid, we were looking at the labor and delivery unit, for example. It had three beds side to side, separated by curtains. You've got one resuscitator or baby warmer. So you might have three deliveries at the same time, and you have three babies stacked side to side on one baby warmer. They didn't have, a simple thing as a name tag, just a bracelet to have babies identified. We had just a tape, like, you know, the medical tape, and you write the name of the baby, weight, date, and time of birth, and then just stick it on their wrist. And they're It's slippery and it doesn't, it's not the best. So this is what we used. And also when they are just born, so basically the baby is, you know, babies come out wet, right? Like the amniotic fluid and all of the blood, all of that. We didn't have blankets to dry them off. We had diapers, adult diapers to wipe them off. It's insane, but at least we had something to drive the baby off with. And imagine the chaos of like three women side by side giving birth at one instance. It can, like, there's no privacy, the screaming, that like how we try to calm people down, just kind of give birth, and it's almost impossible. And
I mean, there was a photo that I saw on your Instagram page of a baby that had just been delivered. And because there were no clamps for the umbilical cord, that you had to tie it off with like the strings from a mask, like a surgical mask.
So there were clamps, but the clamps were bad quality. So we had a clamp that we put on. I actually brought with me some clamps from Canada because one of the things that COGAP was specifying, do not bring any medical equipment whatsoever.
COGAT is the bureaucratic arm of the Israeli military. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes.
So so they were super happy. The midwives were super happy that I brought proper clamps, because the clamps that they were given, they might snap at any time, and just like the first 24 hours specifically, if the umbilical cord is not clamped properly, it baby can bleed out and you might not see it. And they're so tiny. So like what 100 ml is not going to do much for an adult, but it's going to be catastrophic for a newborn because of their size and the circulation, like in terms of blood volume, they can't tolerate a lot of blood loss. So you are facing really like a disaster when you're having this kind of, it's very unsafe. So if the innovation and how people have been resourceful, and the midwives like cutting the lace of the mask, soak it in alcohol. So when they put you put the clamp, and then you fortify it with that. So I was really dumbfounded by this.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's sadistic that the Israeli military continues to prevent basic medical supplies, menstrual pads, medications, diapers, you know, suture, whatever it is that is like basic necessities that we don't even think about here. In North America.
We take them for granted, right? And that's part of the privilege that goes unchecked. And just really what we struggle the most for people who have gone to war zones and conflict areas to come back to the reality of the healthcare here, and how people verge on the side of like being so entitled and not really checking what they have in terms of privilege. That risk is never present for people here. The clamps are not going to just be faulty like that. And it also like it speaks to the dehumanization of Palestinians, that these supplies were allowed, but they're the faulty supplies. So you don't even get the right to have a proper piece of equipment or a necessity, because you know these are animals, like, and you know the Israeli government on and on and on and on, like all of these like their officials talking about, like, just saying it blatantly, that these are animals, we're not gonna allow them food, electricity, water, and fuel. So why not kill their babies by giving them faulty equipment
in full view of the world? You know, it's not like this is a secret even. They've been saying it openly. They've been doing this deliberately in order to cause maximum pain to every single Palestinian in Gaza, you know, even unborn, you know, Palestinians in their mother's wombs.
Well, I mean, the children of darkness, right? Like, why would Palestinians deserve to live. If they're the children of darkness, they need to be annihilated. That's that's Benjamin Netanyahu's quote from his many, many, many genocidal statements. Yeah. So to me, when people are saying, well, it's just the government, who elected this government as well?
That's right. That's right. Hiba, the labor and birth process is, of course, extremely delicate and requires hygiene and medications, clean water, nutrition, which without those fundamentals can easily lead to serious medical issues. What kinds of infections were you seeing? And as a midwife, how were you able to treat them?
Unfortunately, we weren't able to treat them as well as we wanted. So one of the things that were very common, having yeast infections, because the lack of access to clean water. So people, again, privilege. You need to imagine this, like you go to your faucet, you turn it on, you get clean water, right? In Gaza, like you're lucky to have a faucet to get water through, first of all. So if you're living in a tent, you're actually having to go fetch water. And you've got the salt water and you've got sweet water. So salt water, because one of the first targets of the IOF were the desalination, factories or plants. Yeah, thank you. So people, like, just accessing water has been so difficult. Like, it's really a major problem. So you have all these women that need to access to clean water, but they're using salt water. And, you're really like, you can't wash your clothes properly in that salt water. You need access to washing. There's no washing machines. Like, you're washing with your hands and you're like the cleaning products, etc. So what we take for granted as the basic cleanliness, our hygiene, they don't have that. So, and also being pregnant, you're more prone to having infections. So you need to have, like, that's even more pressing need to have access to clean water, and they don't. So they come and then you see people having yeast. It's untreated for months. Bacterial vaginosis, which is usually when the normal bacteria in the vagina turns hostile and doesn't serve the woman as like a barrier against other bacteria. It becomes hostile itself, and it just causes irritation and infection. So that was really common. And the problem is, I can't just take a swab and run down to the lab and process it. And you're like, oh, yeah, I can confirm you have BV or bacterial vaginosis, or yeah, you have 100%. Yeah, you have yeast, or let's just treat you and have access to antifungal medication or antiprotozoal, etc. Or just if someone has vaginitis, which is an infection in their vagina, they're able just to access antibiotics. So that's one problem. So with that, like when the person has an infection or the woman has an infection in general in that area, it goes untreated for months. It does affect the integrity of the skin and deeper tissues. So as a result, when the person or the woman is trying to give birth and you have such fragile and what we call just basically like just unfavorable tissue, the risk of tearing increases. So as a result of that, there's a lot of healthcare workers like midwives and OBs have reached the conclusion of like, we need to cut episiotomy. So an episiotomy is like making a cut this big with scissors in the area between the vagina and the rectum or the anus, and just make a cut to make room for baby to come out. And this is an outdated practice to do it routinely without an indication. And unfortunately, it's being done because this perception of of like all these women have infection, and instead of having a tear that might extend to their rectum and having problems, they'll just cut everybody. And that was such a concern of mine, of like, there's not actually no evidence to actually support this practice, but still it's being done. So that's the consequence of thinking people like, and seeing that a lot of women had infections, and in order for us to prevent like worse tears, then let's just make these cuts. In terms of, that's one thing. And then the other thing is like, even if someone just tears just like a tiny bit on their own and don't get cut, the healing process of like, you know, after pushing a baby out, it's like really delayed significantly, because you know, healing requires proper nutrition, hydration, and hygiene, basic stuff. So I saw this over and over, like, and also, you know, it's just like in terms of smell, in terms of all of that, like, it's just not comfortable. The itchiness of that people, you know, or women would experience because of the infection, the irritation, like on top, like be on top of being so miserable in a tent, let's say like it's in the middle of a summer, it's 35 degrees. It's very humid and you're itching. You're just like, it's so itchy, so uncomfortable being pregnant and malnourished and dehydrated. And as a result, also having urinary tract infections because of the dehydration. It's just compounding. Like, that's just, it's beyond miserable. I was healthy. I wasn't pregnant. And I was like really struggling in the sense of like, okay, this is like so intolerable, but then you have to tolerate it because you have no other choice. And I was a healthcare worker that is in a hospital or in a safe house, like an apartment with access to water and just access to things that just people in the tents didn't have access to on the in the schools that they were displaced in or whatever place they were sitting in. So it just to put in things into perspective, I think it's important. And as other women witness this around the world and advocate for women's rights and having access to basic human rights, I think it's important. And people are just being silent, like health authorities, health sectors in the West, like not really standing up for these women and these vulnerable populations or children even.
And
that's a small portion of the labor and delivery experience, right? Like there's also the emotional safety. It's important to have emotional safety. It's not just physical. It's to have a companion to hold your hand and tell you everything. They're there. Everything will be okay. And you got them. Like, even like if you can't promise everything will be okay, like at least I'm going to make sure you're safe, and someone to hold your hand and to keep saying that to you, give you a massage, give you a back rub. It's just the oxytocin that will help this, which is the hormone that is important to keep labor going and for people to feel that love and connection to their babies and offspring. It was so difficult to get a companion in, because when you have three women laboring at the same time, and it's one room, mind you, and it's just tight space, and you have the midwives and the OBs or the residents, like we, and maybe a med student there, you don't have a lot of space, and also not privacy for other women, like having a companion. And they have to be female. So, you know, women were not allowed to bring their husbands or partners in, male partners. So it had to be a female relative. And that was very difficult to get. So the emotional support piece that is a cornerstone of the experience and having a safe delivery was not there.
It's just unspeakable. You know, for anyone who's ever had a loved one go through the experience of pregnancy and labor and delivery, I think we all know, you know, or for those of us who have gone through that ourselves, like we know how intimate and private and vulnerable, you know, we are, and to have no semblance of basic safety In terms of like, you know, you don't know if you're going to get an infection or if you have one. And if you do, there is no antibiotics. The stories about women having to endure cesarean section births without proper anesthesia and then having, as you said, to go back to these, you know, tent shelters in either sweltering heat or, you know, freezing cold weather with no hygienic supplies at all, and the emotional trauma of doing all of this within the context of a genocide. I don't think there are, you know, I mean, we said this before we started recording, but there are no words to describe.
It's unfathomable, to be honest. Yeah. And just running downstairs to the pharmacy to get antibiotics, you might get one, you might not. And yeah. The south of Gaza at the time, because I was in the south, for people to have some perspective, there was some medical supplies that are going in that, like, and in July, June, it was a bit different versus now. It's getting worse. So the north of Gaza was like, there were C-sections happening without anesthesia. I was fortunate to not witness that. I was to be honest, I was preparing myself to go through that experience. It's really excruciating to witness, let alone experience, obviously, as a woman, but having to deal with that. And it's just like the trauma on the person and the providers. Like, it's not easy to be the person who's holding the knife as a scalpel and opening someone who's without anesthesia or barely, like, you know, has like a little bit of anesthesia. So luckily we had access to that and in Al Audun Sirat. So I was grateful for that, to be honest. So I did a big part as well of my work there as a surgical first assist, because I got training to assist in C-sections. So I was with the right hand of the surgeon, basically, or the obstetrician during C-sections. And luckily we had access to spinal anesthesia. There were some women who were so traumatized, they didn't even actually want to be awake during their surgery. So they would actually ask for a general anesthesia, even though it has more complications, but they're like, I don't want to be awake for this. And also the countless stories as we are, performing the C-section while the woman is awake, she's talking about how she lost her dad, she lost her family, maybe lost a kid or two, and then, you know, continuing to just like survive and live, like literally the definition of resilience. How people here in the West say, oh, you're so brave for speaking up. These folks are actually surviving, and that is the definition of bravery. It's not just speaking up, it's actually surviving in the face of a genocide and continuing to have babies and resist through that, where they are targeted and like the Israeli government and society is like wanting to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their lands and their ancestral homelands. Like, that's what's not being said in the media.
No. Yeah. No, not at all. Hiba, you were there 6 months ago, and now the situation is catastrophic, especially in North Gaza. As The Lancet and many international humanitarian aid agencies are reporting, the exacerbation of trauma with starvation, lack of water, lack of hygiene is resulting in maternal and infant mortality rates on a massive scale. The authors of The Lancet report say that, quote, Gaza's mothers are denied their most basic right, the ability to give birth in safety and dignity. The women of Gaza are not just statistics. They are mothers who mourn the loss of children they will never know. They are survivors of a crime that continues to strip them of their humanity. Can you talk about what your colleagues in Gaza are saying these days about the situation for maternal and infant health in hospitals around Gaza?
I think it's hard because what they talk about is like, yeah, we've seen it. It's nothing new. Nothing new. We're exhausted. We need this to be over. And people are just experiencing like a massive scale of loss, and they feel for their patients. They cannot provide postpartum care. You can't just go around and carry a kit and provide postpartum care for your patients. So they are very concerned. And to be honest, like also the fact that they are themselves, they might die any day. So that's the other thing that they're like, I don't know, we're waiting for our turn. And when I talk to them, it's just like not a lot. We're like, yeah, alhamdulillah, thank God, we're all good. We're all good, you know. We're just waiting for this war to end. So the Lancet has, you know, it's really described the situation. I can't add more to that. The people are not doing that well. They're exhausted on the ground. They're waiting for a ceasefire. It's not coming. It doesn't feel like it's actually ever going to stop. I know historically all wars stopped, all genocide stopped. They do stop at some point, but at what cost? It's at the cost of murdering children and women. And, you know, the Palestinian woman is the like really a symbol of resistance and steadfastness, sumud. So when you're obliterating that population, you are actually killing hope. And I think that's the big piece to it. And my colleagues there, some of them actually want to get married, some of them want to have kids themselves. They just feel like it's not safe to do so. So they're really concerned about their patients, their concerns for themselves and their safety, their own families, like, because I mean, they're human too. So it's just, I'm always feeling, whenever I'm done with a conversation with one of my colleagues, there's just a tremendous amount of guilt that I feel, and just a tremendous amount of anger and injustice. And, you know, there's an Arabic word that's cannot be translated into English, the al-qahr. It's like the experiencing oppression day in, day out, racism, dehumanization, and just let that go for 76 years. This is what Palestinians have been experiencing, and the dehumanization of them. So the Lancet have said it over and over, like they issued a study, or like a report, sorry, back in July. They issued another, like, it's not about issuing just a statement. Now we need action. These folks just cannot fathom living through this genocide yet another day. But here we are, 400 and how many days? Nine
it's
days,
like almost 410. Yeah,
410. A day in, day out. So that's how my colleagues are doing, and they're just witnessing still the murder of their families, the colleagues as well. Like the morale is so low, because when you have your head of hospital being taken hostage, and you don't know what's going to happen to him. You know, the story that's coming about Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh, like, it's just horrendous. Like, as a healthcare worker, you're not even safe. Like, you could be gang raped, taken to torture camps, and literally no one knows what's going to happen to you. And your body, after you experience all of that, might not be even given back to your family. Like, having to deal with that, it's just beyond anything that I could even touch on today. I don't know if I answered the question, but it's just,
no, you did. It's unspeakable. It's all unspeakable. Yeah. The medical mission that you were a part of was facilitated by GLIA, which is one of several medical organizations that was able to enter Gaza until May of this year, when Israel shut the Rafah border crossing. Yeah. And since Israel has kept it closed, they've banned certain medical organizations from facilitating missions. Then they like reversed that policy, nominally allowing them, at least on paper, to do their work. But the border remains closed to people and humanitarian aid. And at the same time, COGAT, which we mentioned earlier, the bureaucratic arm of Israel's occupation, has openly declared that no international personnel with Palestinian heritage or ancestry is allowed to enter Gaza in a medical mission. And that's been just, allowed to have been just unchallenged as of now, as though it's just normal. It's normal operating procedure that they can say that this, you know, very deliberately, very clear racist policy is just kind of matter of course. Can you talk about these arbitrary and racist denials of entry to medical workers into Gaza?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just excruciating. And again, the double, like the just the hypocrisy of this being Israel being the only democracy in the Middle East. And then they get it's
the only
really,
democracy
honestly,
in the universe. Yeah.
and then having to deny people based on their ethnic background and ancestry from going in to help people in Gaza. It's just I don't know. I honestly just cannot find the words anymore to describe this kind of deranged behavior and way of thinking. So as and also it's not just you have like if you go down if you go back three generations, so your grandfather, dad, and I don't know, great grandfather. It's crazy to me. Like they're gonna look into that lineage and say, well, you know, you have Palestinian ancestry. You can't go in and help your fellow Palestinians or your people. So it's a form of. To be honest, like torture, and it's just the least that I can do, for example, as a Palestinian in a diaspora, for me to go in and help my people. And even that, sentiment is being denied. So it's really problematic. And then the other thing, there are people actually have no ties to Palestine whatsoever, no ancestry, nothing. Nothing, and they were just denied. No reasons provided. Keep that in mind. There is not always a reason. You can just be denied. Yeah. You can't enter. Why?
And because it's a Tuesday, right?
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, like, the experience that I went through is like, okay, well, you are entering as part of. So, mind you, here we have Tuesdays and Thursdays that we're allowed to enter and exit as an emergency medical response team. Okay, the aid at the time it was allowed to go in like maybe 70 trucks a day maximum. The fuel is a different story. Like you have a very specific amount of fuel that's going to enter, and most of the hospitals were, I think, like there's a lot of them that were partially functioning. So there was no hospital that's functioning on full scale. And then you have the emergency medical teams, and they have only allowed 20 to 25 people to enter and 20 to 25 people to exit. That's serving a whole strip of 2.2 million people. Like, how does that make sense? Like, that math does not make sense. And as per international law, Israel is an occupying force. And it is mandated to serve its occupied people, and still they are not held accountable, and they are not going by any law. They're just acting with impunity, and continue to dehumanize Palestinians. And part of that, block the aid, block the hope, because mind you, I go into Gaza. Okay, all these people meet me, the healthcare workers, the patients. They're like, "Thank you for being here." And we gave them hope, even though going in only for initially it was for 2 weeks, and then COGAT actually makes it very hard. So you have to stay a minimum of 4 weeks. So any healthcare worker that works somewhere else that is limited in how much vacation they can take, so you are now to extend it for 4 weeks. And keep in mind, you might not go in the date that you were told you're going to go in. They might deny your entry or push it or just postpone it for no reasons. No one holds them accountable. No one says, "Hey, you said you're gonna go in on the fifth. I'm gonna go in on the fifth." No, it keeps getting pushed. So that's what happened to me. Like, it kept getting pushed, and finally, I was able to go in. So the torture and the anxiety of okay, you might not actually go in. You might be denied. Oh, the date gets pushed. So instead of me going for 2 weeks there, I had to go there for 6 weeks. And I wanted to extend, to be completely honest with you, because I run the risk, they might actually deny your re-entry. So if you want to do another mission, if you were allowed the first time, you might not be allowed the second time. There's no guarantee. So whether you're Palestinian or not as well, despite the racism against Palestinians, even as just a human being who is acting on from a humanitarian law perspective. So you're being impartial, or like, you know, I'm not pro-Palestine, I'm not pro-Israel, I'm just pro-humanity. I want to go help people in a conflict or a war zone. There are some folks like that. These folks can be denied for just no reason. MSF, that has been neutral the whole time, they're actually asking for a ceasefire, and they're actually taking a position of like, this needs to stop, like a permanent ceasefire, this is unacceptable. And it's all falling on deaf ears. And because the United States is backing up Israel, no one is going to be able to say, you know, they veto every single resolution to stop this genocide, and they continue to fund the genocide. So yeah, it's just it's anyway, I don't like, I don't know, it's COGAT is, it's a whole can of worms that is, yeah. Just how do you enable the occupiers of Gaza and the West Bank and Palestine to be the ones allowing aid? Like, you, it's really like having the just the criminals and the people who are committing this genocide being also the judges and being the people that are supposed to help the people they're killing. I don't know. It's not something that makes any sense. And if this is any other country, it would have been different. And it's really,
that's right.
It speaks to our humanity and apathy.
Yeah. Hiba, what keeps you up at night? What, you know, when you think about your experience working as a midwife in Gaza, and the kind of, you know, stories and statistics that are coming out now, all these reports, and still nothing is changing for the better on the ground for these women and these families and these babies. What are some stories that you keep thinking about, you know, that you see, people that you saw, women that you worked with in Gaza, that you still think about now?
Yeah. There's a lot of things that would keep me up at night. First is, you know, we the whole like Muslim nation, for example, like the Arabs. It's like, where are you? Where are you? There's really like, we're as you know, people are Muslim and you believe in a day of judgment, and you'll be asked of, what did you do to help these vulnerable people in need? How did you show up for them? And for sure, we do boycott, divestment, sanctions. But as a large community, and like all of these countries, like, what? Why aren't you saying anything? Why aren't you doing anything? So that is like really difficult to wrap my head around. And just to, it's like all of these women that have lost their children and all of these innocent lives, and you know, it's like the voice of the voiceless, that they don't have a voice, and where is our collective responsibility? So for me, I'm like, have I done enough? Basically, that's what keeps me up at night. I want to do more. I want to show up more. I want to tell the stories of Palestinians. How can I live with myself? And I know people say, oh, like, you went there, don't be too hard on yourself, but still ongoing. Like, I have the privilege to leave, and what you know, what stays with me is like some midwives were like joking and saying, hey, can you put us in your suitcase so we can come with you? And I'm like, yeah, I wish. They don't have a choice. I do have a choice. I was able to exit and they couldn't. There's some people who are terminal and they need some you know in dire need of medical evacuations, and they get denied. COGAT denies medical evacuations, and then another receiving countries, they have nothing, and also nothing to say, like nothing to be like, force Israel. No, you don't get to say no to these people. They need to be evacuated. So that really, I think, what I can think of right now in terms of just having to live day in, day out with the privilege, the guilt, and just the lack of action. And I understand that change is slow. And I mean, the history doesn't show any fast action when it comes to genocide, to be honest. So that's a big piece to it as well, like looking at history, how long World War One stayed, like just, you know, went on for how many years. Same thing with World War II, with other genocides. And we have a live stream genocide like this that never, it's been unprecedented in that sense. And still, we have all this information. We have all of these of this evidence, and then we are debating whether this is a genocide or not. And the U.S. is vetoing, and no one is able to stand against a, you know, a global power. It's just the feel of powerlessness, I think. But still believing, being hopeful and optimistic, are that our voices are making a dent in this world and this like nonsense that we're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of continuing to make a dent, how has working in Gaza impacted your work as a midwife in the so-called West in Canada? What can you tell your colleagues in the midwifery and obstetrics world about what women and families are experiencing in Gaza as this genocide continues? And is it even possible to organize medical workers, healthcare workers, midwives, doulas, in terms of you know, being loud and unflappable voices of dissent and of reason and humanity against this genocide?
Yeah, I think a few things for me is like at any chance I'd speak up, because it's the beauty of the, you know, humans. Usually, if you have one voice, one person speaks up, then more people, that somehow inspires courage in people to speak up despite the fear of losing their jobs, or job, and like, you know, just threatening their livelihood. But also keeping in mind, I still have the privilege to be afraid about losing something. I do have a choice. In Gaza, like, people have no choice. The perspective that I got, which I had from before, but it's just even stronger, that this I'm like, I'm safe in my home. I have access to all of the basic needs, and they don't, and they can lose a loved one in a blink of an in a blink, you literally have your whole family die. So, I mean, I know this idea of like, okay, not everybody's able to speak up, and I cannot tell people to speak up, but that's the least we can do in terms of showing some sort of solidarity on a human level. You don't have to be pro-Palestinian to just see the humanity of it all and how it's just a decent, if you're a decent human being, you're able to speak up against this. If the fear is very silencing and just kind of people, I've had people who told me, I'm just feeling muzzled. I get like speaking truth to power is difficult. I don't have it in me. Then we have other avenues like boycott, divestment, sanctions. Like, it's about time. Just, it's not just protest and showing up for protests, is actually doing something that might inconvenience of, like, you know, the average individual in the West of, like, you know, grabbing a Starbucks or having McDonald's. And, you know, it's like people say, oh, but that one meal is not going to do anything. But actually, if it's collectively, we are, every single one of us is boycotting it. It worked. It worked in South Africa. It can work again, you know, and it is working. Like, I know, like, for example, Carrefour is has been shut down in Jordan. They had a very strong BDS base where they actually closed a major chain closed. So it does work, but it's just like to have to come together, like find your community, speak up, organize better, and you know, reaching out to politicians and keep talking about it. And I think that's the most important thing, and not to be scared of, educate yourself on Zionist talk points, Zionism 101, and like the that's something that we're faced at work. This whole thing of like, there's two sides to every story, have to be neutral. I don't want to make people feel unsafe, and just the conflation of feeling, being uncomfortable versus being unsafe. You're safe. No, there's no bombs that are being dropped on you. Your family is safe. This whole concept of like weaponization of safety and my feelings are like, no, we're actually in a reality right now, the physical plane, that is like, you are completely safe emotionally. Whatever story you told yourself that made you feel these feelings, like, is it feeling unsafe or uncomfortable? Like, maybe you dig deeper in that sense. So I'm big on that, to be honest. Yeah, just continuing to speak truth to power.
Hiba Al-Nashef, I am so grateful for you and for being with us today and telling us these really harrowing but very critical stories that need to be told, you know, on behalf of the women in Gaza that you worked with. And I know that you are a caretaker of those experiences that the world would rather just ignore. And so for that, I'm just incredibly honored and privileged to have, you know, been able to talk to you about all of this today. Hiba, where can people go to follow your work? Anything else you want to say about what you've talked about today?
Thank you so much for having me and for opening a platform. And I see that you work so hard, you know, every day. I see all that work that you've put in, and I'm so, so appreciative of that. And I just cannot thank you enough. I could say that my thing is like, have I done enough? And have I given the Palestinian people enough representation? Did I actually pass on their stories? And I that's one thing that I'm always like working on. It's a work in progress, just to kind of show up for Palestinians and speak about them, because one of the things that I take is like, just let it be a tale, as Naruri had said. So really continuing to tell the stories and just never stop talking about it. And I have my Instagram. I think you can put that in the link. Post. And the article, if people want to know a little bit more in depth, and there's just more of like readers, like visual learners, and want to actually read, there's the Mary Claire article. And I'm always happy to talk about specifics a little bit more in the future as well, if people Wonderful. Are interested.
Yeah, I'm sure they will be. And we will put a link to that article. I was very pleasantly surprised that Marie Claire, you know, a fashion magazine here in the States, was able to do such an incredible job at talking about the experiences of women in Gaza giving birth. I mean, just unexpected.
Shout out to Liz Flock. She was incredible. Yeah. She's the journalist and the writer of that article. And just, it was amazing to be able to connect with her and just hear, like, just for her to hear the stories. And one of the things that I didn't talk about here today, like, you know, having to give birth while there's a quadcopter that's shooting outside, it's a horrifying experience. So we touch on that a little bit. So it's like, there's just countless stories, to be honest. Like, it was 6 weeks of witnessing mass casualty every day, almost every day. So it's just, the stories never stop. And I don't know, it's incredible the how people continue to live, and they have no choice in Palestine, Gaza. Like, they just survive. They have no other choice.
That's right. Hiba, thank you so much. And please come back on the Electronic Intifada anytime.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you. Thank you.